What do you think when you hear the word hospice? If hospice conjures up the idea of giving in to death, you'd be challenged by my guest today. Hospice care can be a great comfort to those nearing the end of their lives when staying in a hospital offers no hope of recovery. Hospice also offers support to the families and loved ones. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we have a number of experts who will help explain exactly what hospice care is, what it's not, and how it's changed. We'll also look at palliative and respite care. And we'd like to hear from you. Hospice, comfort and care at the end of life. This is Maine Calling. And we'll give you the contact information in a moment to join the conversation. First, though, a welcome to my guests. David Gian-Siracusa is Director of Palliative Care at Maine Health. Arlene Wing, CEO of Hospice of Southern Maine. And joining us from Augusta, Candace Powell, Executive Director of the Maine Hospice Council and Center for End-of-Life Care. Thank you all for joining us. We'll invite Carol Schoenberg via phone in a few minutes, and we'll introduce her at that time. I want to start with you, Arlene, and just get to the basics of what we're talking about here. In the open, we suggested that there are some misconceptions about what hospice is and is not. What is it?
Hospice is a type of care that's provided for people who are in the last time of their life, at the end of their life's journey. It is for people who have a life expectancy of 6 months or less. And the care is what we call palliative in nature. In other words, it's aimed at providing comfort rather than having its goal a cure for the illness that is leading to that limited life expectancy. There's a team of providers always in a hospice program. It's a team focus for care. There are physicians, nurses, social workers, hospice aides, volunteers, and social workers and chaplains that come together to provide what we call holistic care. We're providing care for that person, not just their physical symptoms, but for them as a social, emotional, and spiritual being as well. And we're providing support and education and information for their family and the people that are providing care for them.
So what is it not?
Hospice is not care that completely takes over for the family. We're there to support the family and the people providing care for that person that is dying. Hospice is a kind of care that is there for people through those last months and days. Some people think that hospice is only for the very last few days or hours, but actually people can come into hospice early on in their disease process as long as their physician can certify that in their best judgment that person has 6 months or less of life expectancy. So that's one of the misconceptions, is that it has to be very, very near the end of life. It can be, people can be playing golf or sometimes working part-time and still be in hospice.
Yeah. David, medically, how, because the cutoff is, or the in order to qualify for insurance, I believe, for most of these hospice programs, the six-month period is the sort of the gauge. How do you determine that? Is it easy to look at a person's prognosis and say, yes, they're within a six-month place?
Well, deciding or making a decision about how long a person has to live is an impure science. And we have a number of guidelines that are helpful in terms of particular aspects of the way an illness is affecting a given individual. And it's really around those particular guidelines, assessed by two physicians. But also a very important component is how the patient is functioning, because we know that how one is functioning in terms of being able to do simple tasks, get up out of bed, move about, walk, also has a significant bearing on how much time they will have left. So we use our best judgment to define and identify people who, if the disease runs its expected course, that a 6 month or less prognosis would be expected.
Candace Powell, let's go to you in Augusta. If we could talk a little bit about the hospice structure in Maine. Is it growing? If so, how much is it growing?
Yes, it is growing, and it has grown over the years. 10 years ago, the statistics were very different than they are today. We've, in collaboration with our hospice partners in the state, have increased the Medicare hospice utilization tremendously, actually. The last time the data was run, 2009 Medicare claims data, actually showed that we ranked now 28th in the country in utilization of Medicare hospice. That means those individuals that would qualify and would be appropriate for Medicare hospice were receiving the services. It continues to increase. We've gone from like 37.8% to 39.2%. However, we haven't kept up with the national average. So the more recent statistics show that we've kind of slipped from 28th in the country in utilization of Medicare hospice down to 30th in the country. But still, the number of patients that are referred to hospice does increase. Last year, about 5,500 Maine people were seen and received services from hospice programs in this state, and that amounted to about 340,000 care days from hospice service delivery. So that's considerable. The referrals, however, come in very often at the last minute, as you've heard from Arlene, and that's unfortunate because the longer a family can get to know the hospice providers, the staff, the more support they can offer the family. So it just is a win-win situation for everyone.
Right, well,
but we continue to increase.
Yeah, sorry, we'll get back to that question in a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation today, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, find us on Facebook and give us a message, or you can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Arlene, wing back to that. Why is it that so many people wait until the last few days even to take advantage of this service?
I think there are many reasons and many barriers to accessing hospice care. In our society, many people have great fear of the dying process, and as a result, it becomes a taboo topic. People avoid talking about it, and the conversations don't happen until it is so obvious to everyone that time is now progressed to the point where death is imminent. And as Candace mentioned, it is then a lost opportunity for people. We hear very often from people, if only I'd known, I would have come into hospice so much sooner. When they come into us earlier on in the disease process, we get to know them one by one. The team members over time become trusted, known people to the person that's dying as well as their family, so that when the time comes when things are changing more rapidly and death is nearing, they've got this trusted team around them. Things can be managed one by one as symptoms come up, as opposed to waiting until death is very near, when often there are multiple symptoms out of control and it's harder for the team to do a good job, and they're trying to get to know a whole group of people that are strangers to them. It's a very different experience. So it is much better quality-wise and comfort-wise when we can have people in the program earlier on.
Is part of that trying to get beyond the sort of reaction that people have when they hear the word hospice, mm-hmm. which means, okay, we've stopped, you know, doing this American thing of fighting till the last second, and now we're accepting death finally. Is that what they're afraid to do?
I think that's part of it. And often we hear healthcare providers express the concern that if they give that news to a person who's dying, that all hope will be lost and that they might feel responsible for that. And what we know is that people will have their hope change to become a realistic hope. The person that's dying can actually be locked into silence if no one's talking about the fact that they're dying. And many, many people also tell us, I always knew I was dying. It's just that nobody wanted to talk about it, and I didn't. And sometimes we'll go to admit a person to hospice, and someone will greet us at the door and say, don't tell Mom, she's dying. And Mom, when we go in, will say, don't tell my loved one, I'm dying, they don't know. And it locks them into silence. Once that is enabled to be talked about, the support can begin. The person who's dying begins to be able to take control, make decisions. They feel empowered. They can begin to process. Some people might still choose to deny it. That's their choice. And some people use that as a coping mechanism. But most people will begin to use that time and see it as a gift, that time that they have to do what needs doing.
David, John Siracusa, this is a difficult moment in the process of life, where you have to be honest with the family and with the patient. How do you say, look, we've done what we can, but maybe it's time? How do you word it? Maybe it's time to think about hospice. Maybe it's time to think about a different course. How does that conversation happen?
Well, one thing that is very important is really the development of the whole field of palliative care. And there is now a recognized subspecialty of palliative care. And I would like to take this opportunity just to make the distinction that palliative care is focused on all the issues that Arlene has shared about the kind of care and the philosophy of care that hospice is. But palliative care that is non-hospice is available to people as they are treated with any other sort of medical care. And in order to get non-hospice palliative care, one does not have to be within a certain time of the end of life. And what we're really doing more and more of as time goes on is to partner subspecialty palliative care with the very best of standard medical care, such as oncologic care and surgical care. And that has been very helpful because it's exposed both the healthcare field as well as patients and families to the benefits of palliative care in general. It also has provided opportunities for increased conversation about the course of events, for honest conversation, but also providing the support that's very important to provide the patients and families, but also it's an opportunity to support healthcare providers, for which there still may be a feeling of failure if the patients get sicker and they approach death.
So does that come out of the medical culture, or does it go back to medical school, or what's at the root of that?
Well, initially, medicine was not able to provide the type of scientific medications as well as very technologic interventions. By that I mean procedures that it now can do. And so in the early ages of medicine, really being there with a patient and family and being supportive was one of the only things that could be done. And I think we're recognizing that that's as or more important now that we have sophisticated technological care. I think from a personal standpoint, I think each professional care provider wants their patients to do absolutely as best they can. And we would all like to see people cured and recovered. But I think there is becoming more honesty about the course of events and sort of also partnering with patients and families to bring them into the conversation and to share options and Sharing those options includes discussion of hospice earlier.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more on understanding hospice care. Share your comments. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
Wake up to the world.
Hello, I'm Dan Damon, host of the BBC's World Update program, and I'm here every weekday morning with all the latest global news, views, and analysis. From Tehran to Tokyo, wherever the news is, World Update will make sure you know about it. So don't let the world pass you by while you sleep. Wake up to me, Dan Damon, and wake up to the world.
Join us for World Update weekdays at 5 a.m. As you know, many businesses and organizations in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on the MPBN radio service. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting MPBN, either on MPBN radio or on MPBN television, visit our website, mpbn.net. Click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions and contact information, or call us at 1-800-884-1717. And ask for Susan Tran. And of course, thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by summer at the University of Southern Maine. Over 500 courses on campus and online, usm.maine.edu/summer. By Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco. And by Camden National Bank, celebrating the genuine, the trustworthy, the heroes of every day. More online at camdennational.com.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're talking about end-of-life care. My guests, David John Siracusa, Director of Palliative Care at Maine Health, Arlene Wing, CEO of Hospice of Southern Maine, and Candace Powell, Executive Director of Maine Hospice Council and Center for End-of-Life Care. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now is Carol Schoenberg, who is Volunteer and Bereavement Services Director at Hospice of Southern Maine. Did I get that right, Carol?
You did.
Okay, thank you. Carol, talk a little bit, if you would, about bereavement services. That's sort of another leg on this stool, and it has to do with the loved ones, the family members, and how they deal with this experience?
Yes. So in hospice, we certainly see the family as the unit of care, which means that we are here to provide support for family members who are grieving after their loved one dies. And that might be anyone who's a family member or just someone in that person's close circle of friends. And most people that I come across don't have the awareness that hospice does follow families for 1 year following the death of their loved one. With our program that includes every family member that has said they would like to have us reach out to them, they receive a monthly mailing, and that's some very good general bereavement literature that people let us know they find very helpful. We also offer one-on-one bereavement support and counseling to anybody who is interested in that. And we provide bereavement support groups. Last year, for instance, we had 10 8-week bereavement support sessions. Each is for an hour and a half, and that's open to the families we serve as well as people in the community. With our monthly bereavement mailings, I think it's important to note that every month we send out approximately 1,500 mailings to our families. We have an annual memorial service once a year, And also we do all of these services we offer to the community at large. So it doesn't need to be someone who was necessarily served by Hospice of Southern Maine, but it can be anyone in the community. And those deaths often might be, rather than an anticipated death, which is how we think of a hospice death, they might be a sudden death or a suicide, any number of other ways that folks die.
Let's talk a little bit about the process of grieving. It's my sense that people maybe believe that they that humans are sort of already equipped with the tools they need to grieve, and it's a natural process, and they really don't need help from anyone else. Thank you very much, and it's just a part of life. Is part of what you do is trying to help them get beyond that and accept some guidance or comfort?
Well, I think it's important to note that, in fact, not intervention and grief support isn't actually needed or desired by everyone. The studies show that maybe 40 to 50% of folks who experience the death of a major person in their life will find that because they have a wonderful support network around them, based on all kinds of things, their type, their nature, their worldview of death and dying, that they don't need to have a support group or one-on-one counseling. So I think my job isn't so much to convince people that they need to have this, but rather to take my lead from them and to recognize that the gift I think that we all have within us is resiliency, and some people more than others. And so I see always the power of the inner, of the, I would say, human spirit to be very resilient. The people that we serve in our program, I find that they're very grateful that our services are here and that we can make a difference for folks. But important to remember that not every single person needs outside support. They're lucky enough to have that in their circle of friends.
We'll go to calls in a moment. But what are the consequences of grieving that is not being handled right, or if someone's having difficulty with the grieving process?
I think the consequences are really great. You know, we see things like a delayed grief or somebody that, for whatever reason, they're not able to process their grief. You know, we have different styles. We have people that avoid their grief, which is a coping style, and people that approach it. So you can see things like people who, after this major loss, they find that they are unable to, at some point in the future, to once again achieve joy and find meaning in their life. It can impact negatively every aspect of their life, from their personal relationships to their employment to how they relate to the world.
And they may not know that it's a result of this death.
I think often that's true, yes.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Orrington and Laureen. Hi, Laureen. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you. I have a question. Can you describe actually what a hospice provider does, say, in the day in the life of a hospice provider? What do they hands-on actually do?
Arlene?
It would depend somewhat on which of the disciplines are providing the care. So, for example, the role of the nurse is a little bit different than the role of the social worker and so on. But I'll pick out the nurse as an example. So if there is a nurse providing care for someone in their home in the community, the nurse will visit, the nurse will conduct assessments, meaning that nurse will ask questions and make observations to determine what are the issues that need addressing. It might be physical symptoms like pain or nausea or vomiting. It might be that the person is experiencing spiritual distress or emotional distress. It might be that they need help with managing affairs. And the nurse might be helping to coordinate some of the other team members to come in and help address some of those issues. Nurses can do some of the hands-on care, assist with medication and medication teaching, change dressings, teach family members how to provide hands-on care, because many people don't understand how to care for someone who's unable to care for themselves.
Maureen, are you in a position of thinking about needing investigating hospice care?
No, not at this time.
Just curious.
Yes, because you hear so much about hospice, but I didn't know exactly what they do. Do they come to your home? How do they actually help?
Yeah, there is this perception that hospice is a place that you go to, but in fact, hospice takes care mostly at home.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, the majority of hospice services are provided in the person's home, whether it's their own home out in the community or whether they live in a nursing home or an assisted living facility. In Maine, we also have two inpatient hospice facilities. There's the Androscoggin Home Care and Hospice House up in Auburn, and then there's the Gosnell Memorial Hospice House in Scarborough that's part of Hospice of Southern Maine, and those are hospice facilities that are staffed with expert team members, physicians, nurses, and all of the other team members that we described earlier on that are there to provide that 24-hour care when symptom management needs that level of care and can't be provided in a home setting. But the vast majority of care is provided in people's own homes.
Candace Powell, let's talk a little bit about insurance, because I'm sure that some of our listeners will wonder about this. Is it covered, hospice care covered, and what do you need to know about that as you head into this process?
Yes, there are many insurances that cover or provide benefits for hospice. Medicare is the primary insurer. The majority of the population is over 65 who do receive hospice care. MaineCare also provides hospice reimbursement, and other commercial insurers in the state, because of a law that was passed in 2001, are required to pay hospice benefits as well. So there is a variety of insurers and reimbursement for hospice services. And those programs and those individuals who might not have any insurance, I think it's safe to say that our programs in the state do everything in their power to provide care, maybe from an endowment fund or community donations, to make sure that everyone who wants hospice does receive that care.
Is it longer than 6 months, though? What happens if you're in hospice for more than 6 months? Does your coverage end?
There's an evaluation period, a certification period, it's called, periodically, where the interdisciplinary team sits down, reviews the case, and determines whether that individual still qualifies for hospice care. And if that determination is made, even though that person may go beyond the 6 months, if that certification is made, and the question is really, would you be surprised if your patient, if this patient died within the next year, and if the answer to that is no, I wouldn't be surprised, then usually, given some other criteria that David was speaking of too, that person can remain under hospice. That person, if he or she decides, however, maybe they want to try a clinical trial or something during the course of their hospice service, they can opt out of hospice and then do the clinical trial. And once they stop that, if they make a decision later on to stop that, they can once again come back under hospice care if they once again qualify for it. So all of this information, hopefully, is given to an individual or family right up front when the hospice nurse sits down with that family to provide information so that family can make an informed decision.
And David, patients do go in and out of hospice and indeed come out of hospice sometimes and live a few more years.
That is true. We call those graduates of hospice, and there's really a misconception that all people who go on hospice die, and there are a percentage, believe it's around 10-20%, but for the individual it's 100% who are able to, who do get better, and actually we know from a lot of experience that patients get better when they're on hospice care, and they actually, there's evidence that they live longer when they're on hospice care. And as I say, some do graduate from hospice and may live for a considerable length of time afterwards.
We'll take more calls in a moment. We'd like to say goodbye to Carol Schoenberg. Carol, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Carol is a volunteer and bereavement services director at Hospice of Southern Maine. And we're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Republican candidates on the stump are saying the America they love is on the line. Writer Jonathan Chait says they might be right. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point this evening at midnight. Join us after Maine Calling this afternoon at 1 o'clock for the Commonwealth Club of California. The guest is former U.S. Senator Russell Feingold. He's also the author of While America Sleeps, a wake-up call for the post-9/11 era. In the book, Feingold offers his account of what he sees as America's recent mistakes and advances a realignment of objectives designed to build a successful global future. Widely known for his efforts to spur campaign finance reform during his 18 years as a U.S. senator, Feingold was the only senator to oppose the Patriot Act of 2001 and the first to propose a concrete timetable for the dissolution of American troops in Iraq. Join us for the Commonwealth Club of California this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, hospice care. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. Our guest, David John Siracusa, Director of Palliative Care at Maine Health. I've tried my best, David. Arlene Wing, CEO of Hospice of Southern Maine, and Candace Powell, Executive Director of Maine Hospice Council and Center for End of Life Care. Let's go to the phones now and to Wolfboro, New Hampshire, and Jim, who's waiting patiently. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to commend the program. My family and I used it in Massachusetts in the late 80s, and we took advantage of all of the aspects that you've just outlined among the guests. Interestingly, one volunteer came from a separate local church, and she plied my mother with tea when I went out, to get a break and hike. And she didn't know that my mother had incontinence. But later that woman became my wife. So other than that, it was an absolutely transforming experience for my family and for me. My mother lasted a year after the surgeon diagnosed her death. It was spot on in terms of his diagnosis. And it was just enriching because we had time to say goodbye. She was able to die peacefully in our home. And I can't say enough good about hospice.
So, Jim, did she provide at that point what we might call respite care as you were the caregiver?
Well, the respite care came from my siblings, and the volunteer came simply to allow me to take a break from the 24-hour, 7-day care that was required for the last 4 to 6 months of my mother's life.
Arlene, a little bit about respite care. We haven't gotten to that, but that's sort of this sort of giving the caregiver a break from time to time.
Mm-hmm. There are actually 4 levels of care that are provided through the Medicare hospice insurance benefit, and most of the other insurances in Maine now mirror that benefit. Respite level of care is one of those levels, and it's actually an inpatient level of care that's for up to 5 full days at a time, intended for the relief of whoever is the caregiver for that person that's dying. There are also other ways, as the caller just mentioned, that relief and support can be provided. Volunteers will often provide that function of coming in and staying in the home while someone runs an errand or has a nap or paints or does whatever is their favorite activity to be able to have some relief for a short period of time.
Let's go to Waterville and Lillian. Hi, Lillian. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
I am 87 years old, and until 4 years ago, I was a hospice volunteer and worker. I'm a massage therapist, and I'm not sure that all branches of hospice have the luxury of having a massage therapist. I always said I wasn't paid by real money, that it was I wasn't covered by insurance. I was paid by the donations that people gave to hospice when somebody died. So I went in, and it's kind of an answer to the one who wanted to know what hospice workers did all day. I went in and gave the massage to the patient in their bed or in their recliner or wherever I could get at them. And it was not to make them, to fix them, I always said. It's just to make them feel better while they're there.
Lillian, did you ever befriend these folks, and did you feel a sense of loss when they died?
I felt, I'm sorry, it chokes me up even now. I feel a sense of loss every time one of them died. Some of them outlived their time with hospice, and I was with them for quite a while, and I grew very fond of them.
What is it like, any of you, for volunteers, for staffers who are working in hospice and going through this every day, these intense emotions? Does it take a certain personality?
Well, I think what I used to tell them is my form of insurance. I know that I'm there for them, and when I need it, there will be someone there for me.
We often, those of us that work in hospice, we often hear the question, isn't it depressing to work in hospice? How do you do that? And when I first started working in hospice over 20 years ago, at first, when I was new to the work, I didn't know quite how to answer it, but I worked on what my answer was because I knew it wasn't depressing for me. It can be very intense, and it can take a lot of energy, and it can be sad at times, but those of us that work in hospice for the long term, I think we would consistently say it's not typically depressing. And my reason for that, and what I hear many other people say, is that you know when you're caring for someone that their physical body is dying, but there's an emotional, social, spiritual being there. And if we can get that body comfortable quickly and keep them comfortable, we're able to have the privilege of helping them do a huge amount of work in those other dimensions. People are dealing with spiritual questions like, what is my life meant? What's going to happen to me when I die? They're dealing with their own emotions. They're dealing with the emotions of those that love them. Socially, they have a lot to do. They're ending all of their relationships. And I remember in a hospice I worked in one time, we had a teenage boy we were caring for, and the team came back. They were talking about his words to them, and he had said he was getting frustrated sometimes by people telling him how hard it was to say goodbye to him. And he said, but I'm saying goodbye to every single person I know. And when you think about the enormity of those tasks, it's huge. But it's a privilege for us to be able to help people say, I forgive you, I love you, say goodbye, ask for forgiveness, deal with those questions. The reward is huge, and it's also life-transforming for those of us that do this work. It's a gift to us. So that's the reward that keeps us going.
David, from the physician's point of view?
I would share what Arlene said, that often people say, well, gee, all of your patients often get sicker, and we are able to do a tremendous amount to help people feel better physically as well as in the other domains that Arlene has mentioned. I think another important aspect of hospice care and non-hospice palliative care is the strong undercurrent workings of the team to support each other and to talk about issues. And in my experience is that a number of hospitals and working with hospice, that talking about how the work is affecting the clinicians is a very important and consistent aspect of the work. But I think it's really, as Arlene mentioned, that feeling of being able to impact people's lives in a very positive way. And I'll just give, if I can, just share one very quick vignette of a gentleman I was asked to see who was terrified of dying. He knew he was dying. And we talked about it, and it turned out he was terrified because he felt bad that he had felt he had been a poor father and a poor husband. And he hadn't been in contact with his son and his wife for over 30 years. We were able to make telephone contact, He asked for forgiveness, as Arlene mentioned, and there was some reconciliation, and that absolved his fear. So it's really an opportunity and a privilege to be close to people in a very, very important time of life.
Let's go to Portland and Jack. Hi, Jack. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I have an experience as a hospice volunteer. I spent about 5 years volunteering. And it's important that people understand you receive a wonderful gift from this. I had an opportunity to sit with a woman who was in the dying process. Her family was not there, could not be there. But she was alone, and it isolated her because she kept moaning very loudly and was keeping people awake all night. So I went into the room, and I held her hand, and I said, Mary, I'm going to stay with you. You're not going to be alone. She stopped moaning. She smiled and even winked at me before she passed. So it does bring peace to have people know that you're not alone, but there's somebody there caring about you.
Yeah, Jack, thanks for calling. Let's go to South Portland and Judy. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the program.
I just wanted to say my mom, who was 92, was in one of the hospitals in Portland, and she had had pneumonia and also quite severe Alzheimer's. The doctor in the emergency room suggested to us that we meet with their palliative care nurse practitioner at the hospital, and this gal was just wonderful. She gave us, different options. And this was the Catholic hospital in Portland, which was quite pleasing to me that they gave us those thoughts and the plan, suggestions. My mom was not able to tolerate any antibiotics, and so we wanted to bring her home rather than have her stay in the hospital. So that's what we did.
Yeah.
And so I would just strongly say anybody who is listening, who's in charge, palliative care nurse practitioners in the emergency room or in the hospital are gifts.
All right, Judy, thanks for calling. Another endorsement. Candace Powell, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to ask about what's on the horizon in terms of hospice care, palliative care, the whole bundle, nationally with respect to any insurance coverage or healthcare system changes that we're looking at on the horizon.
Well, it seems like it changes on a moment-to-moment basis, certainly on a day-to-day basis, both in the state of Maine and nationally. So we hope that, some of our insurance mandates to provide hospice care continue in the state of Maine. We hope that with health care reform, hospice and palliative care will be integral parts of all of the legislation going forward. Hospice really provides high-quality care and does it in a very cost-effective way. Hospice and palliative care providers need to stay at the table and be part of the discussion if we really, truly want to give folks the best care possible and do it cost-effectively.
All right, thanks so much. And we're out of time. We could keep going for a long time. Thank you to my guests, Candace Powell, speaking to us from Augusta. He's Executive Director of Maine Hospice Council and Center for End-of-Life Care. David John Siracusa, Director of Palliative Care at Maine Health. And Arlene Wing, CEO of Hospice of Southern Maine. Thank you. And thanks to you, Jonathan Smith, and our volunteer Cindy Hahn, produced today's program. Cindy also answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board. We had help from Rich Tozier. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.